This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. In 1948, there was a plane crash in Fresno County, California that killed 32 people, four of them Americans, 28 migrant farm workers who were being deported back to Mexico. Everyone died. The bodies of the Americans were returned to their families for burial. The migrants were left in an unmarked mass grave. The Americans were mentioned by name in the papers and on the radio. In much of the coverage, though, the migrants were just called deportees. It was an outrageous indignity, one that folk singer Woody Guthrie attempted to redress in a poem that he wrote. It was later turned into a song sung by a number of folk singers, including Joan Baez.
Goodbye to my one, goodbye, Rosalita. Adios, mis amigos, Jesús y María.
This story of 28 unnamed victims hit home for author and professor Tim Hernandez. He wrote a book titled All They Will Call You, in which he pieces together the lives of the people on that fatal plane trip. Their stories will come to life this weekend in Asheville at the Connect Beyond Festival. Tim Hernandez is a professor in the Department of Creative Writing at the University of Texas, El Paso, and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you.
Tell us more about this plane crash in 1948.
Well, as pretty much as you outlined there, you know, in January of 28, 1948, the United States government was deporting reportedly 28 Mexicans from Oakland, California, back to the El Centro-San Diego border. And about an hour into the flight after they took off that fateful morning, the plane crashed down in a place called Los Gatos Canyon, which is actually located in the county of Fresno in the San Joaquin Valley. The media reports picked up the accident, and at the time they called it the worst airplane accident in California's history. And they mentioned the names of the four American crew members and mentioned some of their and profiled them as well in the newspapers from coast to coast. But the 28 Mexican passengers were only referred to as deportees. And of course, at the time, one of our most iconic folk singers, Woody Guthrie, had heard about it, and he was big on names, and so he wrote a poem attempting to restore the dignity of these unknown Mexican workers, and he assigns them fake names in this poem. And this poem is what later on goes on to become the song that we all know and love today, the one that Joan Baez just played there.
How did you find out about this story?
I'm quite a fan of Woody Guthrie's, but, you know, I wasn't looking for the story, to be honest with you. I was actually just researching a book, a previous novel I had been working on, that took place in the same county, Fresno County, in 1947, about a few months before this accident. So I was researching that, and as I was doing research there in Fresno, at the Fresno Public Library, this newspaper article just jumped up in front of me, and the headline was so jarring, I couldn't help but read it. And it said 100 people see an airplane fall out of the sky, ship plunges to earth. And I read the article, and by the time I was done reading it, I realized that this is the same incident that Woody Guthrie had wrote that song about. And so, you know, I didn't think I would pursue it in any way, but it did strike me as sort of that mystery of who are these people, and seeing this newspaper in front of me without their names, it did, you know, it struck me. And so my own next step was really I just wanted to know where they were buried and who they were. And when I found out that they were a few miles from my home, buried in a cemetery there in an unmarked mass grave, that's where my curiosity and this story begins to unravel for me.
I want to hear more about that, but how did the press accounts at the time characterize the deportees, some of whom were here as legally and some were undocumented, but what was the characterization and the tone of those articles when it referred to those deportees at all?
Right. Well, I mean, just simply referring to them by deportees and not publishing their names, obviously, I think it portrays some of that characterization, is an example of that poor characterization of these folks, but also a very disservice to the human being whose lives were tragically taken, because, you know, it was very difficult then for how would we know which families to inform of this accident, of this tragedy. And, you know, just the business of grieving and coming to closure for these families was denied because of that omission. And so, you know, it's just an immense disservice. Well, on the other side of that fence, we have the four American crew members. All of their families were notified Their remains even sent as far back as Rochester, New York, which geographically was further away than some of the hometowns of people in Mexico where they could have sent the remains to. And so it was just a disservice, I think, a grave disservice to the families. You know, they weren't allowed to grieve and to find closure.
And you made a personal connection to this when you thought about your own ancestry, am I right?
That's correct. You know, I'm the son and grandson of migrant farm workers, and I'm born and raised right there in the San Joaquin Valley where this accident occurred. And of course, growing up with a kind of oral history of my family, you know, my folks always told stories and instilled in me the importance of stories. And so when I learned of this, it was just kind of, it was a no-brainer. It really was more of an instinctual move. I felt like somebody had to find out who they were, and that's how it began.
So tell us what happened next. What was your next step?
Well, I went to this, I found out that they were, like I said, they were buried there in that mass grave at Holy Cross Cemetery. And when I went there and stood before this giant plot where reportedly the remains of 28 passengers were interred. It was just a giant patch of grass, no marker there. I mean, there was a small placard, but it didn't really convey any information. It just said 28 Mexican nationals died January 28th, rest in peace. And so it struck me, you know, it moved me, and enough to ask the cemetery, the people who buried them, I said, you know, do you have the names of the people you buried there? And they looked in their file, and their records, they did have a file for it, but in that catalog where their names should have been, it only said Mexican national, Mexican national, 28 times. And so that's where I knew, well, this was a government program, you know, that they were deporting them. There has to be a manifest. Somebody has to have the names, and I wanted to get to the bottom of that.
Did you find that? As you say, even in those days, you can't get on an airplane unless somebody's got a list of names, right?
That's right, yeah. And, you know, I found out that the Fresno County Hall of Records had their names on death certificates because they died there in that county. But the names were erroneous. There were so many names that were wrong, obviously, glaring, you know, just errors in these names. And so I knew that this was a clue, but it wasn't the final list. And so it wasn't until I found the first family, the Ramirez family in Fresno, and when they had what they had in their possession was the only surviving newspaper from that time in 1948. It was a Spanish independent newspaper published in Fresno that the Mexican consulate at the time had sent back to their family, and they kept all these years. Mm. And in that single newspaper, it had the list not only of all the names, the first, middle, and last name of every passenger, but it also had the last known residents in Mexico where they were from, and it also had their family members, like surviving family members' names. So it was the one piece of newspaper that I basically began to do all of my research with.
What was their reaction when you came to them? They've been sitting on this all this time. When you finally came to them and said, I'm interested in this story.
Yeah, they pretty much said, we've been waiting for you. That was really what the words that came out of Mr. Ramirez's mouth. You know, when he said, do you have a copy of this newspaper? And he showed it to me. I said, no, where did you get that? And he tells me the story. And then I said, can I take a picture of this? And he says, well, I think I've been saving this for you all this time. Hmm. And really, it was with the Ramirez family's help. In fact, it was the Guillermo Ramirez, as I write in my book, Jaime's younger brother, who traveled with me into central Mexico 2 years after I had met them. He and I went together into central Mexico, knocking on doors, looking for more families together. And we did find more families. But the Ramirez family has been really instrumental, kind of amateur research assistants that they are. And they went out there with me looking. And it's been really with their help that I've been able to find a lot of these families.
Well, tell us more about what you found when you went to Mexico.
You know, I found that it's strange because here in the United States, here in North America, we've lived with this story, the lore of this story, only via the song, Woody Guthrie's song. And, you know, but it's mostly been popular folk music, and musicians and folks who follow that have known the story. But Latinos in general, the Mexican American communities, Latinos in general, have not heard of this story, had not. But when you go into Mexico, into these communities, they have, and they have lived with this story in their DNA and in their storytelling, you know, for the last 70 years. So this story was alive and well and on the lips of everybody that we met, and they were ready to talk about this story.
Well, how did they reflect it when you talk to family members? It's fascinating to see in your book these reactions. Again, people have been living with this. For them, it's a palpable story. It's right on the tip of their tongue. We don't even know about it. So somebody comes by, and in this case an American, and says, tell me more. What do they tell you?
Well, obviously there's hesitation. Some of the families we were able to, you know, to contact them in advance and let them know I was coming down and I wanted to, you know, do interviews with them and all that. But other families, you know, we had information for, we had to just kind of very coldly knock on the door without any advance notice. And that was, and they were very, but by and large, most of the families were very hesitant at first for many reasons. One being that it was an unresolved tragedy in their lives that they've lived with. And the instant I come knock on their door and mention it to them, they break down crying, understandably so. They knew right away this is something that a grief that we have lived with in our family for generations. And I saw my grandmother or my grandfather, who knew these people personally and who grieved his whole life for them, suffer, die, not knowing whatever happened to their relatives. And so now here's this, this third generation Chicano American bringing some news. The instant they hear that, they begin to cry. And then they sit down and ask me all these questions that they've never known, these mysteries that the family has wondered, you know, where were they buried? What happened to their bodies? How did this happen? You know, why didn't we hear anything? And so I try and, you know, obviously give them as much information as I know. And then after we kind of, not only in that initial sit down, but over a period of months and even years now, we begin to strike up a friendship in which I learn more and more about who these passengers were.
Yeah, I would think that, you know, certainly not publishing their names tells you a lot about those who were writing the story at the time, their frame of mind and the way they understood Mexican Americans, the way they understood American privilege and all of that. But it would seem to me for the families, the greater indignity would be not being able to be properly buried.
That's correct. Yeah, you know, and that was one of the things to me. I said, you know, obviously it's a huge just a disservice and an injustice to not have their names mentioned in the media. That's obviously, but aside from that, the fact that they were not returned to their hometown, their homeland, with their families, so that the families could find closure, which is a very, now we're not talking about politics. We're just talking about a very basic human, task, a very human undertaking. You know, that people who die, their families deserve to grieve them and deserve to have closure. And at the very least, they deserve to have their names on a headstone, which is what the cemetery told me the day that I said to them, you know, what would it take to put their names on a headstone? They said, well, that is a basic human service that we provide to everybody, you know, and that's right. And they didn't have their names on a headstone, and their families didn't at home, back home, you know, get to have that closure. And, you know, when I was in Mexico, I asked each of these families that I met, can you take me to the cemetery where they would have been buried? Had they come home, and tell me about the ceremonies or rituals you would have conducted here in honor of them had they been brought home. And so they did share that with me in a sense. And as they were kind of revealing these testimonies, I could sense that they were also finding closure, almost sort of being able to relive this idea of a closure for them. Yeah.
And there was a service recently, more recently, at the site in Fresno County, right?
Yeah, that's correct. On Labor Day of 2013, we raised enough money to install a new headstone there now. So there is a headstone with all of their names, including the names of the four American crew members, because obviously omission to any part of society is wrong. And so we included all the victims who died in that crash on this headstone, and the story in Spanish and English. And around the edge of this headstone, it's a 4x8 slab of granite. And around the edges is etched 32 leaves for Woody Guthrie's lyrics, you know, who are these friends all scattered like dry leaves? It's a beautiful, I think, memorial for those folks.
Tim Hernandez is the author of All They Will Call You. He's a professor in the Department of Creative Writing at the University of Texas, El Paso. Now, he's going to be at the Diana Wortham Theater in Asheville Saturday as part of the Connect Beyond Festival. And joining the conversation now is festival founder Jessica Thomason, who joins us from Blue Ridge Public Radio. Jessica, welcome.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be here.
Tell us more about the Connect Beyond Festival.
So this is the second year for the Connect Beyond Festival, and it involves music, film, and literature with the underlying theme about how art can inspire and influence change.
And
so there's panels, yeah, performances, screenings, workshops.
What inspired you to create this festival?
Well, after producing festivals and events for over a decade, I wanted to do something that was a little bit more impactful and more meaningful. And so one of the things that I really love to do is connect people. And that's from just in my community and also the creative community. And so I created something with the things that I love, music, film, books, and put that all together with trying to make the world a better place.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Tim, you're a creative writer by trade, and right. then you take on this nonfiction project. And I suppose this, and I'll address the question maybe to Jessica, but this is a perfect example of that, is where you bring a, sort of the creative arts to a very important social issue. Jessica, is that sort of part of what's behind and under all of this?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's one of the things that we talk about is that, you know, just the different ways that art can have an impact on us. And we all know there's all sorts of songs that have been inspired by social justice. And, you know, Tim is a living, breathing example of somebody who's been moved by something, you know, the song Deportee, and then doing his part to bring people together into that human element that we all are, and then be able to do something like give closure to all these families.
Give us a sense of some of the other features at this year's festival.
So there's going to be a performance and presentation by Kishibashi, which I'm really excited about, which is happening on Friday evening at Diana Wortham. And he's got a new album that's coming out, but he's got this song film that's coming out next year, and he's really done this exploration with this film about what it means for his Japanese roots and minority identity in the United States. And so that's a really beautiful piece. And then we have, there's a lot of interweaving of these different disciplines. So music, film, and literature sort of together. Because even, for instance, with Tim's performance, there's going to be a musical element of that. Johnny Irian is going to be a part of that. And Tim, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're going to be also showing some videos from just your documentation of the book and all these stories, correct?
Right. It's actually a staged performance of all of this work that includes, you know, like storytelling, some obviously videos and slides, and then Johnny Irian's wonderful music. So it's just a real entertaining and also educational experience.
And Jessica, go ahead, finish up.
Oh, I was just going to say, and then, you know, there's a lot of that. There's going to be Bob Boylan, you know, he's got a book called Your Song Changed My Life, and where he interviews all these different musicians about the songs that have inspired them along the way and why they play the music that they play. And so he's going to be doing an interview with a couple of the members from River Wireless and Fantastic Negrito. So he'll be also showing some videos of their Tiny Desk
Bob Boylan, Tiny Desk Concerts, All Songs Considered at NPR. Jessica, you're very well known in Asheville on the music scene there, the owner of Echo Mountain Recording Studio, the co-founder of the nonprofit Asheville Music Professionals. You know, talk about the ways in which that can be helpful, I guess, when you put a festival like this together.
Well, yes. Yeah. So I am the studio manager over at Echo Mountain Recording Studio, and I am the co-founder of Asheville Music Professionals. But, you know, the music world is a really small world, and there's a lot of connections. There's one degree of separation for a lot of folks. And being at the studio for over 13 years, I definitely have pretty far and wide-reaching connections when it comes to music. So a lot of that definitely helps when you're putting on a festival, especially in the second year. You're calling in a lot of favors. And for instance, Johnny Irene's a really good friend of mine, and that's how I got connected to Tim. So
right.
It sort of starts with that in terms of working with friends and people who are creating great work, and then they're connected to other people who are doing great work. And then you find these ways to bring people together and share stories and basically come together and use art to find all the ways that we can connect as human beings.
Yeah, I think, Jessica, that's the genius of this festival, is that it branches out and it gets everybody out of their silos to show what you have in common and also what you didn't know about each other's craft, art, and then the shared humanity that I think also
right.
is essential to all of this.
Right.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we're trying to do, too, is, you know, there's panels and then there's Q&A, for instance, after all of our different performances or workshops and things like that. So we're trying to give people tools and resources to create the world that they want to live in. So, for instance, people like Tim will be completely accessible during the festival. I mean, he's going to do his performance, but you're going to see him on other panels. You're going to see him walking around. You know, I'm sure he'll be on Saturday evening, you know, with the rest of the group of creators watching the Your Song Changed My Life and the North Carolina Showcase that we're going to do after that. So we really try to create that opportunity for the community to connect not only with one another, but with these creators from all over the country.
Jessica Thomason is the founder of the Connect Beyond Festival, taking place in downtown Asheville this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And she joined us from Blue Ridge Public Radio. Jessica, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Also with us, Tim Hernandez, author of All They Will Call You, and a professor in the Department of Creative Writing at the University of Texas, El Paso, going to be at the Diana Wortham Theater in Asheville Saturday as part of the Connect Beyond Festival. And you can find all that at our website, stateofthings.org. Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Just ahead, the beautiful drawings of an unlikely subject, the brain, how the aesthetic and the science came together to win a prize and become an art exhibit. Stay tuned.